Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Choir Fam Podcast.
I'm Dean Leafy, the Director of Choral Activities at Washington State University.
And I'm Matthew Myers, the Coordinator of Choral Music Education at Washington State University.
In our discussions about the current state of choral music and what it will look like in the future, we agreed that more conversations need to happen to bring the choral community together.
And that's why we're here. We bring guests from the worldwide choir fam onto the show to share their wisdom and help make our choral world a little bit closer.
By speaking with our guests, we hope to provide interesting tidbits of knowledge you could use in your day-to-day rehearsals and give you a sense for how issues that matter to all of us are being observed and addressed.
We hope you'll enjoy these conversations as we work to strengthen our choral community. Welcome to the Choir Fam.
So, Matt, how is this week going for you?
This week's going really well. This is my first kind of normal week after four really big things that happened in a row. So, yeah, I'm just like teaching and having rehearsals. It's normal and it's nice. So I'm glad to be back.
Nice. Yeah, so you were off to the NAFME conference.
Yeah, so I was in Washington, D.C. last week. So I presented with Sarah Bray, who was on our show last season.
That's right. Yeah.
So, yeah, we did a presentation on building respectful culture in the classroom. So, like, retreat and community building activities to use with choir. But we also provided a handout that showed how each activity correlates with the national standards, but also the National Institute of Excellence in Teaching rubric. So as teachers are getting evaluated to see if they're like building culture and like being inclusive in their classroom, so many of these activities are like great ways to document that you're doing those things in choir. So
nice.
Yeah. And how are things going for you? We're gearing down to the end of the sabbatical.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So, okay. So all of the project work I've been doing, it's been piecemeal. You know, I had my eyes set on the beginning of the sabbatical, I'm just going to bust out this project. And then the end of the sabbatical, I'll have a little bit more time for rest and rejuvenation, which really is built into the sabbatical. And now I've just sort of done a little bit of both side by side. And now it's time like, ooh, we're getting down there. So the project is coming along. Right now I'm in the process of looking at publishers' websites and taking a look at how they sort their music to understand how one could find the newest and best that they have. So the project's coming along. And once, you know, things happen in the spring where I'm going to give a presentation about this, Choir Fam listeners, we will talk more about it. So that's kind of how it's going. And it's, yeah, but the semester is coming to a head pretty soon. It's kind of scary. Yeah.
So, Dean, you were kind enough to invite our guest today. Can you tell our audience how you know them and why you've brought them here?
Okay. So ACDA went under leadership change and didn't quite know who this Robin person was. And we heard a little bit about her. But then the first opportunity to meet Robin was at the Eastern Division ACDA conference in Boston. I was going to have... I think drinks with Stephanie Weigand and Amanda Quist. And it turned out to be that some of the board members, in addition, Robin was there. And so just had an opportunity to meet her just a little bit on there. And then I think it was a couple months later, as part of NAFME, my duties with NAFME, we were talking about how we might... take a look at the Allstate experience and how that could be changed to have a little bit more access DEI. And so I was presenting in Long Beach at the Western ACDA conference. And so I asked for a meeting and we had some Irish food. I think I had fish and chips, you know, and we had some Irish food, had some drinks and talked about this Allstate experience. And I learned a bunch more about Robin and I'm excited to learn a bunch more.
So here's a little bit more about Robin, ACDA's executive director. So, a native Oklahoman, Robin Hilger is a classically trained clarinetist. She graduated with high honors in 1999 from Oklahoma City University with a bachelor's degree in instrumental music education. She earned her master's degree in school administration from the University of Central Oklahoma and is currently pursuing her doctorate in education and administration and leadership at Southern Nazarene University. She's a national board certified teacher in early adolescence / young adult music with specialization in band. The overarching theme of her work is meeting the identified needs of historically marginalized and under-resourced communities. Robin began her career as the band and strings teacher at Belle Isle Enterprise Middle School in Oklahoma's largest urban school district, where she created the fine arts department. In 2006, she was recognized as Oklahoma's State Teacher of the Year, and she served as Oklahoma's Ambassador of Teaching, traveling more than 20,000 miles, delivering some 200 workshops and speeches focused on teaching, advocacy, and education policy. In 2007, she joined the staff of the Foundation for Oklahoma City Public Schools as the Chief Programs Officer. In 2013, she supported the launch of El Sistema Oklahoma as a volunteer. In 2014, she was asked to join the organization as Executive Director. El Sistema Oklahoma facilitates the development of empowered youth who use music to make strong positive change in their lives, their communities, and the world. El Sistema Oklahoma operates every day after school and is completely free for participating families. In 2017, she was named New Fundraiser of the Year by the Association of Fundraising Professionals Oklahoma City Chapter. Robin also serves on the advisory board for the Oklahoma Youth Orchestras and is a board member for Oklahoma Youth Sing, formerly known as the Norman Children's Chorus. Robin is a connector of people, organizations, and opportunities. She lives in Oklahoma City with her husband, Stephen, and their three cats.
So, Robin, thanks for joining us and welcome to the Choir Fam.
Hey, thanks, friends. It's really great to be with you today. Isn't it so weird when you hear somebody reading your bio? I don't think I'll ever get used to that. So thanks for the walk down memory lane, Matt.
Yeah, of course. it feels a whole lot weird in someone else's voice than your own, I think.
So. It does. And, you know, for anybody who is a cat lover, they can, like, hit me up as a friend on Facebook because that's where you can see the cats. Just saying.
Nice. What are your cats' names?
Gordon, Elliot, and Dorothy.
Nice.
And if you've ever been on a Zoom call with me, you know that they make appearances in the Zoom calls. they have quite a following now, just themselves.
Nice.
So, Robin, we love to start off with the same question to get to know our guests. So can you tell us about how you fell in love with music?
Oh, my gosh. It is my elementary music teacher, Kathleen Reynolds. She actually is still here in Oklahoma City. She is in her 90s. She is a life member of ACDA. So Mrs. Reynolds was my most favorite teacher in elementary school. She is actually the teacher who told me that I could be good at band. And if she had told me to jump off a bridge, I probably would have done that too, right? Like, that's how much I loved her. And so I went home that day. I was taking ballet like 7 days a week, like really training in ballet. And when I went home and told my parents that I was going to be in band, they were like, "What? You're going to join?" I was like, "Mrs. Reynolds told me that this is what I should do." And I sat down that first day in class as a sixth grader. And I really, I don't know how else to explain it other than I knew I would be doing this for like the rest of my life. It was instantaneous, like a light switch for me. I can say, you know, my best times have been within my music community. All the support I've ever needed has been within my music community. When I was out traveling as the teacher of the year, so when you're the teacher of the year in Oklahoma, you travel across the state. I took my instrument with me everywhere I went. And it can be a really lonely experience, right? You're around strangers all day. You don't know anyone. And if I was at a school, I would always say, "When does the high school band rehearse?" And I would show up to band rehearsal with my instrument. And I always found that I had a place that, even if I was far from home, that I had people that I could connect with. And so that's how I fell in love with music, but it's why I keep doing it, because of the enrichment in this community that we can get.
So when you were in elementary school. Okay, you got to do music. There's this there. Was it going to the recorder, then clarinet? How did clarinet like come into the picture? Why are you not a trombonist right now?
I should have been a string bass player. Oh. I'm just saying, I started playing the string bass in college, and I may have missed my calling because I really love to play the bass. But my cousin played the clarinet, and she was 5 years older than me, and she was super cool, right? Jelly bracelets, black eyeliner and nail polish, Duran Duran posters. So like when I said I was going to be in band, I was like, oh, and Rachel plays the clarinet. So that's what I'm going to play. No, there was no recorder. There was no like tryout or anything. It was like, I'm going to play the clarinet. I mean, I guess I'm really fortunate that it worked out. But no real rationale other than my super cool cousin played the clarinet.
Yeah, it's so interesting how we, like, at age 10 or so, you can make this choice that impacts your whole life. And, you know, I picked the trumpet, and, you know, I'd been playing piano for 6 years. And I knew that I was terrible because I couldn't like change from C to G, which is pretty significant as a trumpet player. So luckily I switched to alto sax before fifth grade started. But like, yeah, it could be really easy to get the wrong fit. So it seems like you got a good one. So
I did.
So you got going in band. Certainly, I assume that you had some formative experiences in middle school, high school. Can you talk about how those band experiences helped you to pursue a career in music ed? Like, how did you decide you wanted to teach?
Sure. I think that I probably, I know that some people would say that they are kind of a natural born teacher. Like, I think you can teach people to be a teacher, but I also think sometimes people just have a disposition that way. So in my family, I kind of have the habit of being the cruise director, getting everybody, you know, doing all the things and organizing all my friends and all those kinds of things. So I think it was a little bit of a natural disposition, but I can say that the teachers that I had were incredibly influential, because what I can see now as a professional is they all had a disposition about student agency. So in the classrooms that I experienced, it was not a dictatorship where the teacher knew everything and the students had to comply with everything. I always had teachers who would say, hey, listen, you know how to play this section. Will you go and practice with this friend, right, to go and help? So peer mentoring was a big part of that I think helped get my start. It's super interesting, this journey for me, because when I first started in music, I was in a very large suburban program. That's where my family lived. So there were like 5 bands, 8 band directors. Everybody took private lessons here in Oklahoma City. My dad got a new job in what I know now is rural Missouri. And so we were moving. And I remember, I thought this was going to be great because I was in ninth grade and junior high here in Oklahoma. But when we moved to Missouri, I was going to be in high school. This was going to be awesome. And my dad came home. He moved like 2 months before the rest of the family. He came home and he said, Robin, I saw the high school band in the homecoming parade this weekend. I was like, yeah, parade. We get to do all this stuff. He said, all 12 of them. And I thought he was lying to me, and he was not. I showed up the first day of band, and my high school band was playing things that I had played like in seventh grade. But I had a fantastic director who saw my potential, and I had talked to him about that I wanted to be a music teacher, that I needed private lessons, all of these things. And he advocated for me. He found a private lesson teacher for me. And then he started saying to me, you know, Robin, if you're going to do this, you're going to need to take up a secondary instrument. Do you know how to play the saxophone? I said, no. He said, well, there's a practice room. Here's a fingering chart. You know, holler at me or come in the morning early And I literally started picking up secondary instruments because after some practice, I could start playing right in the band classroom on those instruments. So saxophone, French horn, flute, percussion section. Now, I'm not going to tell you I was any good, but what I did have was a teacher who had a vision. And as you know, in sometimes small schools, you can do a lot of things that you can't do in really big schools. So like in my junior and senior year, I went over to the junior high for like a half day, almost every day of school, because I could walk across the street. And he let me coach the little baby clarinets, you know, like the little sixth graders, or be his band assistant. And I had all my credits, and we're in a super small school district. So it's not a big deal to see somebody like walking out the front door of the high school and, oh, you're walking over to the junior high. Okay, great. This is not a big deal. That never would have happened for me in a large school district. And so when I hit the door of the university, I felt exceedingly prepared. Like it was not a surprise to me that I had to take methods classes and all of those kinds of things. But I'm really going to attribute that to Greg May and Jennifer Schinberger, who, by the way, I ran into in the NAMM show in April, my high school band director. She was a first year teacher when I was a senior at the high school. And we were at the NAMM show, and she texted me and she said, "Are you at the NAMM show?" And I said, "I am." "How do you know?" She said, "I see your name in the program." And then she had posted up on her Facebook, "How bizarre is it when your first year clarinet from your first year of teaching is on the slate of speakers at the NAMM show that you're attending," right? That's like so full circle. So, I mean, that's kind of the journey, but really, teachers should not underestimate what they do to promote teaching as the profession. So I never had a teacher say to me, "Don't do this." I never had a teacher say to me, "The work is too hard." I never had them say to me, "The nights are long and you have to work all weekend," and all these things. All they told me was how great it was to be a teacher. And I still very much am a teacher in my heart. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much.
So you left your high school, went to Oklahoma City University. That was it. And what was that experience for you there? Was that just the performances? It was amazing. You had teaching opportunities. Tell us a little bit about your experiences there.
Yeah. So my mother is an alum of Oklahoma City University. I actually did not want to go to school there. I was all set to go to Southwest Missouri State University. I'd been going to band camp there and everything else. And my mother made me audition for OCU because she felt she had gotten a very good liberal arts experience there. It has a very good school of music. It's very well regarded. And I was like, "Oh, Mom, this is such a drag." She's like, "You already have an audition prepared. So we're gonna go back, visit your grandparents in Oklahoma City, and you're going to play an audition." And it was at the audition that I felt seen, known, cared for. It was a very personalized experience. And this has been my experience with OCU as a student and then past graduation. Like, I can pick up the phone and call the dean. I can pick up the phone and call anybody who is there and receive a level of care and attention as if I was still on campus there. That's, I think most people who go to OCU would tell you that that's within the spirit, that it has a very family orientation on campus that continues even past graduation. So I got a superb education and very personalized and very specialized.
Now, I have an ancillary question. Just now, certainly you had all these plans to be a band director. You did this. You probably never imagined you'd be the executive director of a big choral organization at this point. At any point in middle school, high school, college, did you sing in a choir?
So elementary choir. I sang in elementary choir. That was Mrs. Reynolds' choir. But the answer is no. And you know what? As surprising to me as it is probably to everyone else. But, you know, here's the thing about ACDA. It is helpful that my arts background tells me that it is not a good idea to tell choirs to sing concerts in hotel ballrooms. right? My fine arts experience tells me that. But it's probably also to our organization's advantage that I can read the financial reports.
Right? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So the skill set of the executive director is actually the activation of knowledge in the organization rather than the specialization of the knowledge itself. So I think it's helpful that nobody has to convince me when we're talking about, like, what do performing arts facilities cost, or why would we commission works, or any of those things. I mean, I really get it. But you don't need me to conduct a choir. We have 12,000 plus people in the organization who can do that and do it very well. I'm better served in clearing the road so that the artistry can come through for the people who are really specializing in the artistry. That's probably the difference between administration and being an artist, right? I love the administrative portion. I love the clearing the road and knowing that the work that I do every day, is the outcome of that is really exceptional experiences, right? For students and their teachers and the performances that happen as contributions in the community. But there's a lot of work that gets us to that point. And that's the work that I love to do. Yeah. But yes, it's a little bit of a mystery. I may have said that to the recruiter when they called me about this position. They said, like, are you aware of this opening? And I said, I am. And they said, well, you know, I mean, would you have interest in applying, or you haven't applied? It's like literally down the street from you. And I said, well, I don't exactly meet the profile of the history of executive directors for ACDA, which is true, right? Choral directors,
sure, yeah.
Steve's in the choral knowledge. I think that the board at this time, particularly in COVID and facing COVID, was really looking for a very hardcore administrative, you know, experience, the running of the organization. And so here I am, a year and 2 months. I've been here a year and 2 months.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So we're going to go back in time just a little bit. You finish your degree, Oklahoma City University, and did you go straight out to teach then?
I did.
Okay.
Yes. And in fact, I was teaching the semester before I student taught in Oklahoma City Public Schools because we had a shortage of teachers in the urban school district. And Oklahoma City University has a history of training music educators. There are two state teachers of the year out of the School of Music in the last 10 years, myself and Peter Marcus. The State Department, they didn't want to lose the programs. The school district did not want to lose the programs, but had no way to fill the staffing. And a partnership was developed between the school district, and the State Department of Education in Oklahoma City University that placed some of us very early in classrooms. And like, I had a sub that like sat in the classroom that was like the teacher of record, but I was teaching the class. It's very unusual.
Yeah.
And of course we were cohorted together. So there were six of us. Everybody is still in the field, by the way, teaching arts administration, but everybody in that cohort is still here and active. And so we had something to hang on to. We also had our professor, John Schimmick, who was our, you know, department chair for music ed. We had support from the superintendent, the fine arts director in Oklahoma City Public Schools. So it was very supported, position. When I think about doing that now, I'm like, oh my Lord. Do you ever think about stuff and you think to yourself, man, if somebody asked me to do that today, I'd be like, no, I don't think so. But I mean, then the opportunity to help, the ability to learn, the programs were not that big. So I mean, yes, I went into teaching early and then stayed.
So then after teaching, after a certain while, looks like you got a little bit of a bug regarding administration. That's why you went back for your master's in, you know, school administration. What made you just sort of, well, because there's, if you're going to go back for your master's or you're going to get supplemental education, there's certain avenues you can take, you know, why that one?
So when I was at the Foundation for Oklahoma City Public Schools, so by the way, I accidentally went into administration. So
you slipped.
I don't know how it actually all happened, but I had been teaching. Then when you're the teacher of the year, you're on sabbatical because you're traveling. I had been doing work with the Foundation for Oklahoma City Public Schools. I had been coordinating their student performances for events for school district groups for a while. I came off of sabbatical. I went back to my school and I had a friend who was there who said to me, this person who was there was retiring. And I was like, oh, that's so sad. You guys are really going to miss her. Who are you going to get? And she was like, you. I was like, absolutely not. You are not going to get me. I am not going to leave my school. And she's very persistent. You know how these people are. They're very persistent. So then, like, I don't know, maybe like a month goes by and she calls me and she says, hey, we're getting a new executive director. You do so much work for us. I'd really like for you to meet her. Can you guys have coffee? So I had a student teacher at the time. And I was at that point where, you know, you need to leave your student teacher alone in the classroom. So my student teacher was on deck. I went down to the office and I had arranged it with my principal that I was going off site during that class period. So to go have coffee. And when I came back, my principal said, how did it go? And I said, I think I just had a job interview. And she said to me, if they offer you a job, you need to take it. And I was offended. I know I like looked offended at her like at first. And she was like, she said, no, I'm not even joking. They haven't had a teacher on staff there in the entire time that I've been an administrator in the school district. And if you get the opportunity to go there and they will give you the opportunity to restructure things to make them really work, you should do it. You really should do it. And she was like, and I was like, you're kicking me out of the nest, you know, all the things. But a very influential mentor, Lynn Keller, she's still here in Oklahoma City. And I had a job offer like within 24 hours. I remember talking to my husband at the time. He really encouraged me. I prayed a lot about it. It was pressed upon my heart. So like, I knew that it was a step that I was going to take, but it's not like it felt good. Does that make sense? I made the decision at spring break. The only people who knew were my husband, myself, and my principal. And I cried every day in my principal's office on my plan period, knowing that I was exiting. So I took this sort of accidental turn to administration, but really they gave me full scope. The foundation here is very powerful within our community. They have a lot of resources. They have access to lots of decision makers and really gave me full scope to retool programming.
Does it make you weary of getting an invite for coffee now?
No, because man, when people call, you know, Dean, you said, can we meet up? And I said, what did I say? Yes, absolutely. Yes. Let's do it. I feel like so many good things have happened in my life, just saying like, yes, and doing those things. So I typically am like down for that, like most of the time, particularly if there's food involved, like that's a really important part of it for me. So I went to the foundation, talk about the master's degree. I didn't want to be a principal. I was doing tons of work with principals and with community partners. There, I felt like there were a lot of assumptions that people were making from an external community standpoint. I'm a business person. I want to support the school district. I'm a community member. I want to support the school district. And I would be in meetings and they would say things like the principal should be doing this and should know this and da 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 da. And I thought to myself, huh, I wonder what it is that principals really are trained to do. And as a state teacher of the year, you have tuition waivers in Oklahoma. So I said, okay, I'm going to do it, because then I can sit at the table and I could say, actually, no, that is not within the purview of the principal. And that I would have more knowledge about how to support the work of the principals that I was working with. So I thought maybe someday I might be a principal, but I didn't actually start that degree to be a principal, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Oh, I think there's a really important nugget of information in there that I think that could be a source of frustration for so many people. And you did the opposite of, you know, you're educating yourself so that when you are at the table to make decisions, that you can really know, you know, that you have trained yourself to be a good decision maker in the role that you were offered. And I just think that's so commendable. Like, even though you did not necessarily see yourself being a principal at that time, that you wanted to know what that was like, so that you weren't making decisions that, you know, could have a negative impact. So I wish more people would take the time to educate themselves. Anyway, soapbox.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Matt. I mean, I will say this. I can't be like entirely altruistic about it. Like, could I have made that decision if I didn't have tuition waivers? I don't know. I mean, there's a point of privilege in there that allowed me to activate, right, that curiosity. I'm really glad that I did. And I think that it has helped me a lot. I mean, when you think about the administrators that school principals are, my goodness, they're amazing administrators.
Yeah.
So in the interest of time, we are going to fast forward Robin's life here up until 1 year and 2 months ago. So you had mentioned that a recruiter had given you a call and said, hey, why don't you apply? This could be something. You get the job. And tell us a little bit about how that all worked out. I mean, from our end, lovely. So let's just say this. So you get into this organization. There's challenges due to COVID and so on and so forth. Ah, now you're starting a job. Oh, what's going on? So tell us a little bit about your onboarding here for ACE.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the first thing to know is that everyone who's in volunteer leadership in ACDA has been so welcoming, so generous, so flexible, kind, just really supportive, right? There's a learning curve here. If you're not kind of raised in the way of ACDA, right? Like, if you didn't go to honor choirs and state festivals when you were a high school student and kind of up through the system. And so the generosity of the time that people have spent with me has been just really incredible. The other thing that I can say is, like, my nonprofit friends, when I tell them like how volunteers work in this organization, and I say, you know, like, people meet early, people meet late, people meet on the weekends. All I have to do, if I send one email and I'm like, hey, folks, I'm going to need you guys on a call. Everybody's like, all right, it's at 7:30 Eastern, 6:30 Central, 5:30, whatever. And here we go. And there's the meeting. This does not happen. The support, the membership leadership within ACDA is very exceptional. It is very exceptional. And people work their commitment to ACDA like a second job, a plus-plus job. And because of the level of care and stewardship and love of the organization, it makes it very easy to love the work and the people who are here. I think that the firm that the board contracted for the executive search and the recruiter himself, Jonathan McIntosh, as well as Hillary Appelstadt. So Hillary was really integral in this process as well. I think they did a very good job of defining the quality, skills, traits, and characteristics of the leader that they were looking for. And I also think that they did a good job of knowing the strengths, knowing what the challenges in the organization were going to be, and those kinds of things. So, you know, Dean, you talk about, you know, being in COVID and organizational transition and all of these kinds of things. None of it is surprising to me. And I think that that's good news. That's a successful search process. It doesn't mean that it's going to be smooth all the time. But if anything has been surprising to me, it's only been good surprises, which is really great. Now, I'm not going to tell you that, like, during COVID, when, like, every other email I was getting, you know, I get, here comes the first email. I can't believe we're having to wear masks. you know, this is the worst thing ever. Masks are the worst thing ever. ACDA is the worst thing ever. Next email in. I can't believe you're not requiring masks. This is the worst thing ever. And I was like, okay. And because when you have a constituency that's all across the country, right? Like, it is difficult to unify all of those things. So I wasn't surprised by that. Maybe I was surprised a little bit about kind of the lack of communication between people about that, but that seems easily resolved when you're like, hey, let's stop it. And we're going to hop on a Zoom call and talk about what the real problem is, right? Or how we can help you. I think trying to bring a level of, like, transparency. So not just saying, like, this is the rule, but why? How long will it last? How was the decision made? Where can you also look and find your own guidance, right? Putting all of those things out, I think, has been helpful. But overall, like, no surprises. During that very early time with COVID, Andre Thomas had asked me, you know, Robin, like, how's it going? We feel like it's going very well, but how's it going? And I had talked to him about it for a little while. But then I also said, you know, I know very clearly why your job description said a minimum of 10 years of executive leadership experience. So I am grateful for all the experiences that I've had that have led me to ACDA. I feel like I have been well prepared. And when I am not, there is a very strong cadre of people in ACDA that I can always reach out to. For support. And that is, when you have something like that, it also gives you a lot of confidence as a leader, because you know that you don't have to know everything, because you can always source the information that you need. It already exists within the organization. We just have to find it.
So our last little, well, I don't know what little. Our last question here before we get to our lightning round. We were talking pre-recording here a little bit about, you know, you're in this role and you've had an opportunity to see what ACDA was and have an opportunity to see what ACDA could be. So can we talk just a little bit about that? How is ACDA looking to grow and change?
Yeah. So, of course, we're in a really, what I would consider to be a very rapid iteration, cycles of change. ACDA has obviously a very solid foundation, a history of success and of, you know, providing resources and opportunities and all of those things. And we should leverage that. That provides a very stable place for us to build from. And here we are today. We know where we are in our present. My eyes for us are really situated on building the future, right? What is the world that we want to live in? So we're living here today, but what is the world that we want to live in 2 years, 5 years, a decade from now? What will that world look like? And how do we begin that energy, right, to push towards the future of the organization? I think it's incredibly important to us that we are always iterating, because the conditions under which the members are functioning are always changing. University looks different today than it did 2 years ago, than it did before COVID. It will look different moving forward. It's the same thing for music and worship spaces. It's the same thing in the K-12 space. So just because we say that this is it today, we should not think that somehow that work is going to end. Like, oh, we've done it. We're here. We're at the top of the mountain. That's it. We should always have an expectation that we will be doing the next iteration of whatever the initiative is, so that we're constantly finding our relevance and remaining a place where practitioners can find the information that they need. So that will continue to be part of the work, and it's going to happen in these very rapid cycles for a while. And then I think the other piece is the expansion of work outside of conferences. So I've been talking to all of the national leadership and region leadership about this, which is, we already know what we're doing 5 days every year. You know what it is in your region, you know what it is at the national level, and we're very good at it. And these are great experiences and people are there, but there are challenges with that, right? There's equity challenges in people being able to travel. There's expense, there's timing, there's all kinds of things with that. And the work of the choral director is not 5 days a year. It's 365 days a year. So with the R&R committees, with the standing committees in the regions, I've been talking about the other 360 days of the year. We know what we're doing 5 days. What is happening in the other 360 days? I think you're starting to see some of these things really push forward already. So this is a conversation very new from the summer. So we're not that far out from it. But a change, an example of this is going to be from National R&R. So at National Conference, what we would normally see are these reading sessions, super, you know, I call them splash and dash, right? Like 30 pieces in 50 minutes or whatever it is. At National Conference, the R&Rs are going to be offering deep dive sessions. So 3 or 4 pieces that are going to be unified around a theme or a pedagogical approach. By the way, read your January Choral Journal. There'll be all the explanations around how that works in the January Choral Journal. And then for the entire membership, the National R&Rs will be launching large-scale repertoire resources late March into the beginning of April that will be available to everybody. You didn't have to go to conference to get these things. They will be available to the entire membership. And the timing is really important, right? Because if you have resources late March and early April, now you're empowered to program through the summer and into your fall, right? So the timing on these things. But I think that that's probably like one of the first examples of this adoption into these other times of the year. So when you're at the national conference, you're going to get a very specialized experience to national conference. And that is going to be a really exceptional experience. The national R&R chairs are doing an amazing job. And then launching something that is accessible to the entire membership and not place-based later in the spring. So I'm really excited about that. And we should be seeing that more and more and more across the organization.
Wonderful. Well, I think we're going to have to leave that there and move on to the lightning round. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, sounds like a good time for that. So Robin, we'll ask you a series of questions. You don't have to think too hard. Just whatever comes to mind is a good answer. So when you were in high school, who was your favorite musical artist?
Oh, in high school? Probably. I'm an old soul. James Taylor.
That is a great answer. Yeah. If you could pick any career other than music, other than, you know, administrative leadership, executive leadership, what would it be?
I would probably be a spiritual leader.
Yeah, awesome. I think we know this answer. Dogs or cats?
Cats. I love other people's dogs, though. Just to clarify, like, not anti-dog. I'm just not home enough for a dog. And I really think you should steward your pets like, you know, they need walks and exercise and all those things. And cats just prefer for you not to be there.
Sure. If you could be an extra in any movie you've ever seen, what movie would that be?
Oh, man. Twister, of course.
Ooh.
It's very, I probably have been an extra in that movie, just in real life.
Fair
just
enough.
Say.
Okay. Now, you may or may not have an answer for this one, but do you? If you had to pick one favorite choral piece, what would that be?
Oh, okay. So you guys know this. I don't have, a depth of choral experience, but what I will tell you is I really like the Evensong setting at All Souls Episcopal Church that's here. So I'm not sure what you would call that, but I think that it's very beautiful, the Evensong setting. And what is on 24/7 at my house right now is Christopher Tin's Lost Birds.
Hmm. What is one composer you feel needs more attention? Or is there some one or two or three you'd like to highlight?
Let's talk about composers as more generic. I think for us to really think about what are all the pathways that it takes to get to publication and distribution are really important. So we have all kinds of people who are writing choral music. K-12 teachers who are writing their own things because they need them to work for their own kids and their own classrooms don't consider themselves to be composers, but they are. We also have people who would really like to be composers, but there's no pathway for them to build that skill set or go to school and study or get an internship or figure it out. So those are the people that I'm interested in, which is where are those voices that maybe the current pathways are not sufficient to support those voices coming forward. And then the other group of composers that I'm really interested in are students in the classroom. Awesome. Their own voices.
Ah, I love that. What is your favorite memory associated with music?
Oh, I mean, how do you dial that down to like, how do you dial that down to one? When one of my first students became my colleague and we were at the North Central Honors Orchestra, and of course, you know, when you're a director, you're all in the director's room and then everybody gets assigned to adjudication, and we were on the same adjudication panel, and I thought to myself, it's not too long ago that I was on one side of the curtain and he was on the other, right? Playing his audition. And now here we are. That's one of my favorite memories.
What projects are you working on right now that you're excited about?
Personally, I am learning to crochet because I think it's really important to create, and I do a lot of creation administratively all day, systems and processes, but it's kind of a different level of creation. And I really like to make things. So that's one thing right now. And I don't have anything to show and I'm not really making, I'm not like set on making a sweater or anything like that. I'm just like learning some basic things. Here at ACDA, obviously there are lots of projects. What I'm really interested in with those projects, again, is the applicability to the members who are in the field today. What does it mean for people? So can I leave whatever I'm doing with ACDA and the very next day turn it around in my classroom, turn it around to my university students, turn it around, whatever that means? That level of applicability is really important to me.
Awesome. Well, hey, you've reached the end of the lightning round. Now, if our audience wants to get in touch with you or follow you on social media, how can they do that?
So they can like me on Facebook. I have a personal page and a professional page. They're both fine. If you brought Robin Hilger, or Robin Hilger at ACDA. You can send me an email, executive director@acda.org. I answer my own email. Give me a couple days though, right? Like just because just know, but I do answer it, and I like to hear from people because that helps me sort of know what is going on in the field. And I hope to see people in Cincinnati. I'm planning on making state trips this summer. So I hope to see more members in states in the summer. And so if I'm around, don't be afraid to come up and be like, hey, we're all going over here to dinner. You know, it's interesting being a new person, right? Because I don't really know a lot of people. It was super funny when I was out at the region conferences because nobody knew who I was and I was wearing a mask. And so I could kind of go like incognito literally anywhere. And then I would give like the keynote speech at the concert and then it was like on, right? But you shouldn't assume that I have people to have dinner with or anything like that. Everybody always thinks like, oh, you must be so busy, you're all scheduled up. I mean, sometimes the answer is everybody thinks you're all scheduled up and you're not. Mm-hmm. So, so say hi, stop me in the exhibit hall. If we're in the hotel bar, grab something to drink, sit down, because it's really important to me to hear from members.
Great. Well, Robin, it was great talking with you today. We thank you. Our audience thanks you. And we're happy to call you a part of the choir fam.
I am glad to be part of the choir fam. Thanks, friends.
I'm Dean Leithy.
I'm Matthew Myers.
And you've been listening to the Choir Fam podcast.
Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you liked the show, please rate and review. If you didn't like the show, please let us know how we can better serve our choir fam.
You can follow our Instagram page at choirfampod or email us at choirfampodcast@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks again for being a part of the choir fam.